Joining me now on Fresh Air is singer Mel Torme, whose recordings hold a very special place in the collections of many of our listeners. Mel Torme has been singing and recording most of his life. He was 16 at the time of his first recording with the Harry James Band that did one of his own tunes, Lament to Love. You're going to be hearing one of his songs with incredible frequency for the next month, the Christmas song. You know it. It's the one that starts chestnuts roasting on an open fire. You'll probably have the opportunity to sing it, to hear him sing it, on the upcoming PBS Christmas special that he hosts, and that will be broadcast in the Delaware Valley on Channel 12, December 22nd at 9 o'clock. But you can hear him sing a lot sooner than that. Mel Torme is in Philadelphia, performing at the Burgundy Room, which is the supper club that's located in the newly restored Fairmont Hotel on Broad and Walnut Streets. He'll be playing the Burgundy Room through Saturday night of this weekend. Before we speak to Mel Torme, let's listen to one of his pretty recent records. This is from his album Live at the Maisonette, which was recorded in 1976. We'll hear Mel Torme singing What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life?
On the 1st of May, it is moving day. Spring is here, so blow your job, throw your job away. Now's the time to trust to your wanderlust. In the city's dust you wait, must you wait, just you wait. In a mountain greenery where God paints that scenery, just two crazy people together. While you love your lover, let blue skies be your color. Let when it rains, we'll laugh at the weather. And if you're I'll search for wood so you can cook while I stand looking. Beans could get no beanery reception in a beanery. Bless our mountain greenery home. In the mountain greenery where God paints scenery just to crazy people together. When you love your lover, blue skies be your cover. When it rains, we'll laugh at the weather. And if you're good, I'll search for wood so you can cook while I stand looking. Beans could get no keener reception in a beanery. Bless our mountain greenery. Simple cooking means much more than French cuisines. I've a banquet planned, which is sandwiches and beans. Coffee's just as grand with a little sand. Eat and you'll grow fatter, girl. Smatter, girl. Atta, girl. Mosquitoes here won't bite you, dear. I let one sting me on the finger. Beans could get no keener reception in a beanery. And no matter where we may roam, no keener retreat from life's machinery. Beans could get no keener reception in a beanery. While you love your lover, let blue skies be your cover. Let how we love sequestering when no pests are festering. That's our mountain greenery. Ho, 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 mountain greenery. Should it do?
Mel Torme, Mountain Greenery, from his Live at the Maisonette album. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to talk a little bit about your past before we get to the present. You were a child prodigy. You started singing with Coon Sanders' band when you were a kid.
4 years old.
How'd you get to do that?
Well, I was an inveterate radio listener. And my mother and dad very simply took me into the Black Hawk restaurant in Chicago, our hometown. And we heard... to hear the Coon Sanders Orchestra, because I'd been listening to all their radio broadcasts. And I guess I was dressed up in some sort of sailor suit or something. One of the band leaders, it was either Carlton Coon or Joe Sanders, walked over and said, "What a droll little boy." we see him tapping his feet to our music and sort of singing along. And my mother or my dad said, he sings all of your songs. He listens to your broadcasts all the time. He loves the band. So they invited me on the stage, and I sang You're Driving Me Crazy, as I recall that night. And suddenly I became a Monday night feature at the Blackhawk for almost 6 months. I went on there every Monday night. You got to understand something, Terry. In those days, it was the end of the 20s. It was a wacky time. Guys used to buy war surplus jennies and fly them under bridges, and people would sit on top of flagpoles, or, you know, child performers were part of that freakism, that craziness. And so it wasn't really terribly unusual for a kid like myself, I was 4 years old, to indeed be performing with the likes of a famous band like Coon Sanders.
You think it was unusual when at the age of 16 you were recording with Harry James?
No, I didn't record with Harry James.
Oh, he just recorded your tune.
He recorded my tune. It was sung brilliantly by Dick Hames on the record.
What did you think lay ahead for you when you were young? What did you envision a career in music to be like?
I had two basic ambitions. And they warred with each other all the time. They were always warring. They were always locking, you know, banging heads, so to speak. Because one of the things I wanted to do desperately was to be a band leader. I really wanted to have a good swing band a la Charlie Barnett or the Artie Shaw Band or Benny Goodman, and to be able to play drums with it and sing and write arrangements. The other fantasy, based really on, rather foolishly, on what I loved but what I wasn't really equipped to do, was to be a movie star. I really badly wanted to get into the movies. I suppose because I'm a terrible movie fan, I am obsessive about film. And consequently, that was a burning ambition. I thought perhaps I could do both. I was really born 10 years too late for the band era. Because by the time I came of any kind of age, I had a taste of it, because I sang with Chico Marx Orchestra for a year. And don't let the name kid you. I mean, even though Chico Marx was the piano-playing member of the Marx Brothers and wore the little Italian outfit and was called Ravelli, he just came out 20 minutes a night during our one-nighters and our performances wherever we worked. Oddly enough, one of those engagements was the Black Hawk Restaurant for 9 weeks. In Chicago in 1943. The band itself was a very good band, a very swinging band. So I got a taste of it, but I was born too late for it. And physically, I just simply didn't look like Gary Cooper. So that both of those ambitions were died aborning, so to speak.
Well, you made some movies.
Yeah, I made some movies. I've done quite a bit of acting. But that aspect of my career has never reached the zenith of what I hoped it would, what I wanted it to. As you said, what did you want to be? What did you look forward to? Those are things I wanted to be. It doesn't always wind up that way.
Do you wish that there were a lot of big bands now that you could sing with, or to be to lead a big band still? Would you still want to do that?
Well, I think in this day and age, it's really wishful thinking. I don't think the big bands will ever come back as we knew them. They were a product of a time. And as a matter of course, there are enough big bands around now. I do dates with Buddy Rich, quite a few dates with Buddy, Les Brown, Harry James I've worked with, certainly Woody Herman a lot, Jerry Mulligan's new big band, which is a marvelous band. So there are enough, and Basie, of course, there are enough big bands around to satisfy me from a standpoint of being able to work with them. But to be a band leader at this point, I think, is unrealistic. At least it would be for me.
You write a lot of your own arrangements, don't you, that you give to the bands that you play with.
Yes.
What do you try to create in arrangements for the songs that you're going to sing? What kind of support do you want underneath you or behind you?
That depends, Terry, on what the song is. But I'm a great believer in dynamics. I was a tremendous fan of the Jimmy Lunceford Band and of the, and believe it or not, of the Artie Shaw Band. I shouldn't say believe it or not. Why did I say that? Believe it. That was one of the finest bands of the 1939, 1940, 41 period. Particularly in 39 when Buddy Rich played drums with them. That was the optimum Artie Shaw Band for me. And that was a band that dealt inordinately in the use of dynamics, of the highs and lows. So a lot of my arrangements, well, you've been in to see me, and you've probably noticed that, for instance, I do an arrangement of Send in the Clowns, which is a kind of a jazz-based arrangement as opposed to the ballad version of it. It begins with nothing but bass, and then piano in a bassy-like fashion comes in with the drums, and then saxophones almost slide in, they almost sneak in. I'm a great believer in A, B, C, D, and finally E in an arrangement, or if you will, A to Z, to go someplace with it, to build it, rather than almost instantly be blasting or cooking. Because if that's the case, you've got no place to go. One of the toughest things that I find, not only with local bands that I work with, and I'm saying this for a reason, but even with name bands, very few name bands these days grasp something I call nuance. And when a band does grasp it, and by the way, the band on the Maisonette album you mentioned, the Al Porcino Band, was a superb orchestra that was put together of New York musicians who did indeed grasp the meaning of the word nuance. The Bill Clifford Band knows about nuance. And that knocks me out, because it means that on any given evening, I know that my arrangements are going to be played, not just the notes played well, or the interpretation, the connotation of the notes, if you will, but also the fact that they know when to play soft, and they know when to play medium, and they know when to play loud. And boy, that's something that's very tough to teach musicians.
Do you ever travel with your own band, or do you find bands in each city that you play in?
No, normally I use a local band. I'm very fortunate that way, from a standpoint of the fact that the local band leaders know that I write the arrangements. They know that I am, and I hope this isn't a dirty word, demanding. I am demanding. I will give 120%, and I merely ask that the musicians that back me give the same. And I'm so blessed with so many fine musicians around the country who come in and say, look, we're delighted to work with you. We like your arranging. We like your singing. We'll do our best. You do your best. Let's make a show out of it.
Mel Torme, let's listen to another one of your records, and we're going to go back to the 1950s for this one, but it was just reissued about 2 years ago, I guess, by Bethlehem Records, and it's an album I really enjoy a lot. It's of you singing songs that Fred Astaire had once recorded for various movies. They're all great tunes, and we're going to hear your recording of Let's Face the Music and Dance. Do you want to say a few words about the session or the tune before we hear it?
The greatest thing about that whole session, well, there are two things. First of all, Marty Paich, not me. Marty Paich wrote these arrangements. He is a giant. He's a genius. So that's A. B, I suppose the greatest thrill of this whole album was the fact that I rather selfishly got Fred Astaire's number and picked the phone up and called him and told him I was going to do an album that was in homage to Fred Astaire. He was absolutely delightful on the telephone and actually kept me on the phone for the best part of 45 minutes. I mean, not kept me. I would have talked to him for, 45 days. But that was one of the great 45-minute conversations. He's a very self-effacing man. And the whole attitude was, oh gosh, you're kidding. I mean, you're really going to do an album? for a man that is, he's a monster star, a huge star. He's my favorite singer. He's my favorite singer. And so to be able to deal with Fred Astaire even on that one-on-one basis, then I got to know him a little bit. He's a very tough man to get next to because he's very shy. But I got to know him just fractionally. And even that was a great thrill for me.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording from the Bethlehem album, Mel Torme Loves Fred Astaire. This is Let's Face the Music and Dance.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
for the fiddlers have fled. Before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have a chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. There may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance. Let's face the music and let's face the music and dance.
Mel Torme from the album Mel Torme Loves Fred Astaire, a reissue of some of his 1950s recordings. When you walk out into a club, you're seeing a fresh audience, you don't know who's in it. What do you do to assess who's there and what you're going to have to do to get them?
Good question. Well, you know, I walk out cold. I'm not announced. That may be a little impertinent. By the same token, I've done so much television. I've been around so long. I figured that if they're there to see me, they know me. And I sort of like avoiding the sort of, and now, ladies and gentlemen, timpani roll. Boom. The Fairmount proudly presents. I sort of cringe with that. You know, I walk out. I find that if an audience reaction instantly without my singing note one, just by being there on the stage, is vociferous, that audience is going to be a delight. It's sort of pre-sold. Occasionally, and thank God it is only occasional, you do get an audience that as you walk out, I don't believe I've ever had an utterly apathetic audience, but where the applause isn't as strong to begin with, and then you think, well, whatever the mood is, whatever the moon tides are, you know what I mean? However the people are being affected by the moon phases or their collective psyche or the news or the stock market or a lot depends on how people react to the news and, you know, gas rationing, the whole bit. So sometimes, yes, sometimes some stagecraft must be employed to get to the final result. I've always said, Terry, that if I can get on first base, I pretty much can get home. I just got to get on first base. And sometimes that first base is a walk. Sometimes it's four balls and a nice, gentle walk to first base. Sometimes it's a very, very tough blooper into the infield. And on those occasions, it becomes a little bit like work, but that's part of learning your craft, I guess, and dealing with that unknown quantity called the audience.
The night I saw you, the audience was loving you quite a bit, and you were very flattering to the audience as well, saying that it was a great audience and a bunch of great listeners. Did you ever walk out and insult the audience? Or
never would insult an audience, but I am not a prostitute. By that I mean I don't go out every single night and say, oh, boy, gosh, you're great. It really does depend on the audience. We're very, very lucky. I'm a very lucky man. Very rarely does a situation occur where I really think, well, this is kind of a dumb audience or not perceptive or not, you know, not sophisticated, whatever. I really do seem to draw people. As a matter of fact, Judy Morris, who does our public relations at the hotel, as recently as a half hour ago before I came on the show, we were driving here, she said, you know, Mel, you really seem to draw your fans. These aren't just people who are out for an evening and are saying, well, where we go? Oh, well, let's go to the Fairmont. You really seem to be drawing people who want to come and really hear you. I think that most of the people that the Fairmont are going to be buying are going to be people like that. By that, I mean people who love Lena Horne, who like Buddy Greco, want to see him. And the forthcoming artists, the roster of artists that I've seen for the Fairmont Hotel is mind-blowing. It's about time, really, that Philadelphia had a facility like the Burgundy Room of the Fairmont, in which artists like the ones I'm talking about and even squirts like me can come to display their vocal wares.
Well, I didn't notice you performing here till the Burgundy Room reopened.
Well, I have played other places in town, and I've enjoyed it. And I want to say very candidly that
I've
Palumbo's...
I've only been living here a few years.
You know about Palumbo's,
yeah.
Don't you? Well, Frank Palumbo is one of the most marvelous guys I've ever worked for. And a few years ago, I worked for him and enjoyed every single night of every single performance of that. That was fun, but that's an intermittent performance. By that, I mean that I wasn't steadily employed at Palumbo's. So I'm thrilled about the Fairmont. I play all the Fairmont hotels, and I will be playing the Fairmont Hotel here, God willing, again and again and again. I'm already signed for next year. And if the fates are good and I don't lose my voice and I continue to watch my diet, I'm hoping that it'll be a long-term thing. I can start saying hello to one of my favorite towns again on a steady basis.
Good. When you've gotten a sense of the audience and about how they're feeling about you, do you try to figure out who the individuals who comprise the audience are and choose your material accordingly? I mean, have you found that certain audiences like certain approaches to a song or certain songs?
Yes, but the thing is... my act is basically structured. By that I mean that I have a little latitude because I play piano. Last night's second show was a very good example. We had a very loose kind of cooking little crowd, and I went to the piano and broomed out a lot of stuff that I normally do. I didn't do the Porgy and Bess medley that I normally do. I didn't want to be quite that formal. So I sat down at the piano and did three or four tunes that I don't normally do. The band sat back. They relaxed. It was fun. But... in essence, I do principally the same performance every night, which is not to say that I say the same things or that I sing the songs precisely the same way. But I like, if somebody goes out, if Terry sees my performance on a Saturday night and says to somebody on Sunday, hey, you ought to go see Mel Torme. I enjoyed his performance. He did A, B, C, D, and E. If I leave those things out, then the person that you told about my act, is that correct? That you spoke to about me. Yeah, that's correct. is able to say, well, great, Terry, but he didn't do Porgy and Bess that night, and he left out the song by Eric Carmen, Boats Against the Current. So I have to be a little bit careful about that.
Mm-hmm. One of the songs that you sing is one of your own songs, which is the Christmas song, a song that around this time of year you hear on the radio and you hear just walking along the streets and you hear it on television, you hear it wherever you go. How did you write it?
Very simple story. And by the way, on my upcoming, this may interest you because it is PBS, on my upcoming Christmas special that I'm hosting, 90-minute special, let me get a quick plug in. It'll be seen on Channel 12 here. Was it WHYY? Is that
W-H-Y-Y.
Correct?
Okay. And it'll be shown 9 o'clock on the 22nd of December.
Yeah, well, it's being shown on the complete PBS network at 9 o'clock. That's a Saturday night. That's one night, folks. Please forego the Love Boat and Fantasy Island and watch our special because we got great people on it. Rich Little, George Shearing, Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis, Richard Basehart. I mean, just great people. The opening segment of that show, Cold, and I will give a little secret away, is the story of how I wrote. When I say I wrote, I didn't write. Bob Wells and I wrote the Christmas song together. We were songwriting partners. I went out to his house in Toluca Lake, California, on virtually one of the hottest July days I can remember in 1945. I went out to work. We worked every day. We wrote every day. Walked into the house. He was nowhere to be seen. And I walked over to the piano. And on the piano was a spiral pad, notepad, And on that spiral pad was written, in pencil, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Now, that's a very key line, because when Bob finally came into the room, I said, what is this, Bob, this thing on the piano? He said, I'll tell you, I was sweltering today. I was so hot today, waiting for you to get here. He said, I thought I'd write something down, something that would cool me off. I said, hey, that's a great idea, and it, you know, this just might make a song. 25 minutes later, the song was finished. And that's the way we wrote it.
How did it come to you, like in a musical comedy where, in the movies, where Mickey Rooney's walking down the street and starts writing Manhattan?
No, not really. It actually came to me, and to us, to Bob and I, because it was inspired by those four lines. As I say, he wrote the original four lines, and by the way, I want to give due credit. We were a songwriting team. I was the basic composer, but I'm a lyricist too, and I'm very proud of my lyric writing. Bob was a superb lyricist who also had very fine, keen musical insights as well, on a composing basis. So we were a songwriting team. The billing, if that's what it is, on our sheet music says, Words and Music by Mel Torme and Robert Wells. But Bob wrote the most important words to that song, because the first four lines are really the most, they're the ones that people remember. They're the absolutely most important lines of that song. Bob Wells wrote them. But that triggered the rest of the song. That's what inspired it.
It's a beautiful melody. Whose recordings of that are your favorite?
Well, there's one. And you know the one, don't you? Nat King Cole. He was the first and the best. And everybody, you name him, have recorded that song. There are over 500 different records of the Christmas song that have been printed, published, pressed, whatever you want to call it. But the Nat Cole version, not out of sentimentality, believe me, but out of the pure feeling that he got for the song and what it means to Bob and I, Bob and me, that's still the best record.
Do you have a wing of your house or a jet plane that is a result of the royalties of that song?
Well, not exactly a jet plane, but I could have bought a jet plane with it, because the royalties have, quite candidly, and I say this with tremendous gratitude, been utterly enormous. We both figured out, Bob and I, over the years, because we wrote it well over 30 years ago. Remember, we wrote it in 45. It came out in 46, by the way. We were a little bit too late for, even in July, we were a little bit too late for that Christmas season. So it came out in October of 46. We have each made over $1 million apiece on that song. That's on the level. And it's staggering. It staggers me when we finally figured out what our royalties had been. And that, of course, covers records, sheet music, what we call the ASCAP performance ratings on it. It's mind-blowing. It absolutely kills me.
How many languages has it been done in?
Everything you can possibly think of. Records in French, records in German, in Spanish. Name it, it's been done.
Did anyone tell you, any publishers or music companies tell you that it would never make it, it would never work?
Oddly enough, that's one piece of music that I've been involved in, Terry, where from the very get-go, from the very left-hand corner, from the top of it, they said, hey, this is going to be a big song. But I never dreamed, and neither did Bob, and probably neither did Nat Cole, that it would become the monster that it became. It's the biggest record that Nat Cole ever had. That includes Nature Boy, that includes anything that Nat ever did. It is the single biggest record he ever had.
Have you recorded it yourself?
Oh, yeah, 3 or 4 times.
Okay.
But Nat Cole's is still the best.
You going to sing it on your Christmas special?
Oh, yeah, you bet. Okay. The Christmas special, by the way, is called The Christmas Songs, plural. And I think I would be a little remiss and crazy if I didn't do it on the special. Sure.
Mel Torme, let's talk a little bit about some of your non-musical life. You probably have things that you do to just get out of music and entertainment for a while. What are some of the things that you spend your time doing when you're not performing?
Well, I'm a great movie fan. I love to go to movies and I see a lot of movies. But I have since I was a child. Okay, that's A. I became a pilot in 1964, because I've always loved airplanes. And I will admit this to you. I became a pilot because I loved airplanes and was afraid to fly. And instantly thought, maybe that'll cure me. It didn't cure me. I mean, it cured me of flying my own plane. I love flying my own airplane. But I'm still nervous in an airliner, okay? I play tennis. I have a tennis court at home, and I'm a lousy tennis player, but I like to play tennis. I involve myself in some hobbies that are craft-wise. I'm a great model railroad fanatic. I've been building model airplanes all my life, but I've been into model railroads since about the early 60s. And I like to try tying in the things that I enjoy that way with my work. For instance, I produced a show for CBS many years ago called The Singers. And everybody said, you'll never get Cliff Robertson. I don't care if he's a friend of yours or not. He just won the Academy Award. And I said, I'll get him for my show. And I called Cliff and said, Cliff, I've written a whole medley of songs that starts out with, I'm flying high, but I got a feeling I'm falling. And what you do is you sing it while you're flying an airplane. Now, Cliff and I are flying buddies. When he heard that, it hooked him. And I was able to tie in what Cliff loved with my show. Well, now on the Christmas special, I'm a great lover of model trains. I got a whole bunch of AHM trains. I don't know if you know about those people. They're right here in Philly. Associated Hobby Manufacturers are makers of some of the finest model trains, HO model trains in the world. So I'm tying that in with a little bit of a layout with not only AHM trains, but with some very old iron toys that haven't been around for really since the turn of the century, I guess, and making a little train display so I can tie my hobby in with my work, which I love doing. I think people, when they know that you do like things like that, they know that as you use them in your work, that very candidly, you're doing it as a labor of love, just like singing songs. It ties in with that, Terry, because one thing you haven't asked me, and I'd like to answer an unasked question. People always say to me, what about these tunes? You just take the popular tunes and I say, well, for instance, you never heard me sing Tie a Yellow Ribbon on the Old Oak Tree because I hate it. I think it stinks. I don't like the song. I would never sing that song. I only sing what I like. My son, Tracy, who is 20 and going to USC studying cinema, has got wonderful musical taste in a contemporary vein. He badgered me about a song by Eric Carmen called Boats Against the Current. I was going through a very, very unpleasant divorce at the time, and I really didn't want to know about it. And Tracy just kept after me and after me. And finally, I said, Tracy, for heaven's sake, just play it for me. You know, I've heard it once, but play it again. He played it, and almost in self-defense, I said, okay, I'll make an arrangement of it. I'll do it in my act. You know, it's one of the biggest responses I have ever gotten to a song, for a basically unknown song that most of the audience doesn't know. The younger people, of course, know Eric Carmen, who wrote it. But I would never have done it if I didn't really like the song. And all the pop tunes that I've chosen to do, I fell in love with Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, not the original version, but the secondary version that Neil Sedaka did. And that song was a staple in my act for well over 2 years. And I got people saying, please, please sing your version of Breaking Up Is Hard to Do.
How did you treat the song?
As a very, very slow and very beautiful ballad. I wrote a really pretty arrangement on it, I think. Not unlike the way Sedaka does it in that second version, you know. He recorded it originally, as you know, and it was kind of an up version. And then all of a sudden, one day, he came out with this beautiful ballad version. And that's what the song is to me, just as in reverse, Terry. That's what Send in the Clowns is to me. Send in the Clowns is a self-mocking, very Fred Astaire-ish. I think if Fred Astaire chose to do Send in the Clowns, he'd do it, if I may say this, the way I do it. I don't think that he would do it in this very slow, maudlin, mawkish kind of way that I hear most singers sing it. Now, people are used to hearing it that way, and I respect that. I'm not, you know, putting that down if that's the way they like it. But to me, the song is so self-mocking, and it's almost that sort of shrugging off attitude that Fred Astaire used to love, that I chose to do it not to be different, Believe me, not to be... Jack Lloyd gave me a wonderful review, and I thank him publicly for it right now in the Inquirer, as did Tom DiNardo. But Tom DiNardo saw what I was getting at from a standpoint of sending the clowns, and Jack felt that... I think one of the quotes from Jack was that doing it that way is, I mean, it makes as much sense... Well, he has a right to feel that way, and I respect his right. I just don't agree with him. I think it makes great sense to do it that way.
I heard Mabel Mercer sing it once, and she's, I don't know, I guess about 76 now or so, mm-hmm. and she doesn't sing quite like she used to, but she talks her way through her
Mabel
music
Mercer.
Just beautifully. Oh. So she, with her great regal sense, spoke the words and rolled her R's through the
yes.
song. It was wonderful.
Mabel Mercer is one of my great favorites of yeah. all time. I brought Mabel Mercer a song. I'm very proud to say she uses in her act. She didn't know it. It's a song by Noel Coward called Chase Me Charlie.
Oh, yeah.
Well, she never had heard of it before. And I sat with her. I was playing the Maisonette of the St. Regis, wherein this record was made that week, by the way. And Mabel was upstairs in the same hotel in a room they called Mabel's Room. And one night after her last show, I said, Mabel, you got to hear a song. You know it, of course. She did not know it. I played it for her, made a cassette for her of all three choruses and one verse, and she now does it every night in her act.
She did it the night I saw her.
I love Chase Me, Charlie.
Speaking of Charlie, you know, I meant to ask you about this, but I know a lot of people have seen you recently on TV doing the Charlie commercial, mm-hmm. and what does that mean for you? You sing the tune in your act now? What does that mean for you as a singer and as a performer, that association with a product on television, with your appearance within the commercial?
Okay. I saw Bobby Short do it and thought he did it superbly and thought, gee, why didn't they ask me? I'd love to sing that because I love the melody. B, they did ask me. We didn't go after that. They asked for me on it. C, the fact that it is a class quality product, I can live with that. I don't think I'd want to do a beer commercial. I mean, it just isn't me, candidly. Although I must point with great pride to a brilliant singer, a great singer, Vic Damone, who does the Michelob one. You know, weekends were made. He does that superbly. It's only a voiceover, but he does it great. But I felt comfortable with this product with Charlie, and most importantly, D, people. Goodness, people, everybody sees that, and the identification is delightful. And every night that I sing Charlie, I just sing the first couple of lines, and there's always instant recognition and applause. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that?
So it doesn't bother you that people know part of your work from a commercial?
Absolutely not. I think it would be pompous of me to feel that, well, I do that commercial, but I'm very proud of the commercial. They've just renewed me for another year,
uh-huh.
and they've just started playing it, I guess, again, last week, because people have been telling me they've been seeing it.
Yeah, I saw it last week. It's the first time I saw it. But
yeah,
I didn't see
it's been a while since they do it in seasonal quantities, so that now that Christmas is coming, you'll probably be seeing a lot of it.
Well, Mel Torme, we're about out of time, and I want to let you go, because I know you have a busy day and night ahead of you. I want to thank you so much for being here. It was great to meet you and to be able to speak with you on the show. I really enjoyed it.
No more than I did.
I want to play something from one of your pretty new recordings. This came out, I think, less than a year ago. It's one of the new direct-to-disc recordings, a collaboration with you and your good friend Buddy Rich. And we're going to be hearing Here's That Rainy Day. Do you want to say anything about this record before we get to it?
This was a... Yes, I do. Buddy Rich loves this song, and whenever I used to go see him, just to see him, he would say, let's get Mel Torme up here. You know how he talks. He's sort of gruff. He says, hey, let's get Mel Torme up here and sing. He's in the audience tonight. So I would get up, and I would invariably sing Here's That Rainy Day. And one time when we worked together, I wrote the arrangement to surprise him, and he was surprised. I just passed it out and said, okay, fellas, let's go. And Buddy Rich's very prominent teeth. I don't mean he's buck tooth, but he's got very beautiful, large teeth. And it was like lighting up the room. And he grinned and heard me sing it with an arrangement with his band. Needless to say, when we made this record, that was one of the things as a labor of love and a courtesy to Buddy that I thought we would put into the album. That simple.
Okay, I should say I think Phil Woods is with you.
Oh,
on
is
this.
He ever?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. The best alto player I think I ever heard in my life.
Okay, so this is Mel Torme from a pretty new album with Buddy Rich. This is his recording of Here's That Rainy Day. Don't be surprised it opens with Soon It's Gonna Rain. Mel Torme, thanks again for being here. Mel Torme's in Philadelphia performing at the Burgundy Room, which is the supper club in the Fairmont Hotel on Broad and Walnut Streets.
Gonna rain. I can feel it. Soon it's gonna rain. I can tell. Soon it's gonna rain. And what am I gonna do? Those leftover dreams. Funny, but here's that rainy day. Here's that rainy day. They told. And I laughed at the thought that it might turn out this way. Funny how love becomes a cold, rainy day. Funny
Mel Torme with Phil Woods on alto saxophone from an album Mel Torme recorded with Buddy Rich. This is Fresh Air. It's 10 minutes to 3, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And this is scheduled to begin at 3 o'clock. The length of this discussion is subject to question right now, so we'll have to be playing this by ear. We will be joining NPR at 3 o'clock in 9 minutes. I've invited representatives of two Philadelphia-based peace groups to discuss with us their reaction to the possibility of militarism in the Middle East. With me is Michael Maraschino, the Associate Director of SANE, and Jack Malinowski of the American Friends Service Committee, where he's the coordinator of the Human Rights and Global Justice Program. I'd like to welcome you both to Fresh Air. What are your reactions to threats of violence in the Middle East? First, let's begin with how you have reacted to President Carter's